girl. I know it's a bit embarrassing, but I just noticed some tan lines on your shirt.
See, I reckon you're about an 8 or a 9. Maybe even 9.5 in 4 beers time. That blue top shop top you've got on is nice. Bit too much fake tan though, but yeah, you score high. But there's just one little thing that's really, 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 really annoying me about you, you see. Yeah, yeah, like I said, you are really fit. But my gosh, don't you just know it?
I'm not trying to pull you, even though I would like to. I think you are really fit, you're fit, but my gosh, don't you know it?
So when I looked at you standing there with your hoard, I was waiting...
Hi, and welcome to another episode of the 19th Hole Golf Show. I'm Ryan Ballingy. It's good to have you here. Thanks for listening to us for the next half hour or so. We've got the Thursday action in the books from the Northern Trust Open, and that'll be the focus of our podcast this week. But first, a quick commercial for our new addition to the 19th Hole Golf Show family. Each week, we're going to produce an episode of the show that comes out on Mondays or Tuesdays, and they're going to be specifically interview-based. So instead of me talking about a topic or two for 25 or 30 minutes, I'll have a conversation with somebody I find fascinating in the golf world for one reason or another. Maybe they're an entrepreneur with a great story. Maybe they're just someone you really want to hear from. They're funny, whatever. So we want to take your suggestions, and we want to hear from people that you want to hear from. So you can email me, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com, or follow me on Twitter, @RyanBallingy, facebook.com/golfnewsnet. There are plenty of ways to find me. And let me know who you want to hear from, because we want to schedule those people. We think they'll be fascinating to hear from in a more relaxed setting where it's not like a press conference. You're not getting grilled. It's a casual conversation that hopefully reveals those people's personalities and gets them to share a little bit more about themselves. We're presented by BetDSI.com. We use BetDSI's odds each week for our odds to win for our PGA Tour odds posts, and we use them in our fantasy research to indicate to you some of the best options in the fantasy world each week. So check out those odds on golfnewsnet.com. Again, betdsi.com. So there are two main topics, I think, that have come out of the first couple of days and kind of lead through the first round of the Northern Trust Open. And first is Rory McIlroy and his growing spat, which is now kind of dissipated, with Brandel Chamblee. And Chamblee started the whole thing, as he typically does, actually 100% of the time does, on Tuesday in a news conference, a media news conference, conference call, ahead of NBC's coverage of the Florida swing. And Golf Channel and NBC put these kinds of things together every now and then so that media folks can, for some reason, talk to the NBC analysts and get their opinion on where golf is or where it's going. And it's all an intent to drive coverage, to talk about NBC and Golf Channel, obviously. That makes sense. And so Brandel Chamblee has to say something memorable. So he's basically saying that he's concerned about Rory McIlroy spending so much time in the gym, particularly bulking up using weightlifting, and that while he hasn't seen it affect his game too much, that it did affect Tiger Woods, in his view, and it did, and that he doesn't want to see that happen to McIlroy. And apparently the word quickly got out to Rory that Chamblee was saying what he was saying, and all of a sudden it became a kind of issue that McIlroy wanted to respond to. And first of all, before we get into the response, I think that McIlroy responding to what Brandel Chamblee has to say, kind of like Tiger Woods did at times, but McIlroy a little bit more responds to critics, which means he's more aware of critics. So he is not the kind of guy that is going to put up a false front like Bubba Watson says, and I don't read my coverage. All these guys read their coverage. They all read it, for better or for worse. And so they know what the media is saying. So even in a conference call where there were probably like 10 people on the phone, along with Chamblee and a couple other people from NBC Sports, it very quickly disseminated and got into the ear of the world number 2 or 3, depending on the rankings this week, player. That tells you all you need to know about how paranoid athletes can be, for better or worse. That said, so McIlroy decides to respond, and he responds quickly to a Golf Channel tweet by showing a video of him working out, deadlifting a couple hundred pounds. Oh, not deadlifting, but kind of using shoulder press for a couple hundred pounds. And some really weird techno music in the background. But nonetheless, that's probably just what he works out to. And And he says, okay, well, I guess that's his response. And then, okay, well, they have the news conference on Wednesday for the Northern Trust Open. And here comes McIlroy. He goes, kind of leading into the news conference, well, maybe I'll work out today and put Brandel on my back. And so it clearly bothers McIlroy that Chambly, who, again, wasn't all that great of a PGA Tour player. And the guys know that. They know where Brandel was in his career. And they know that he is a good talker, but he has a very specific worldview, and that it doesn't change, and that he really has not evolved very much. Because in a book, Chambly wrote about all the great things about the old golf swing, and swings from the 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, and into the 90s. His thought was that you had to lift your left heel for your best driving accuracy in most distance. Well, that doesn't really jibe with how modern golf swings are taught, but nonetheless, that's how he feels. And so I think McIlroy feels somewhat frustrated. And he feels frustrated. And this is kind of why things like the Players' Tribune exist. And if you're not familiar with the Players' Tribune is, Tiger Woods is a senior editor, apparently, or something like that. But it's Derek Jeter's website that he owns that basically offers athletes an avenue to directly communicate with their fans instead of through the media. And they have kind of people who ghostwrite pieces and things like that. So McIlroy's frustration, the apparent frustration here, is that somebody he McIlroy feels knows absolutely nothing about what he's talking, and that being golf fitness, is saying that golf fitness could be a detriment to his game and spreading information that could be considered either incorrect, misleading, presumptive, all of those things that an athlete does not want to hear. They don't want to hear that about themselves. They want coverage that is fair and informed. Bottom line, fair and informed. Now, they would love glowing and blissfully ignorant, but they'll take fair and informed. And Chambly doesn't come across that way. He basically comes across a guy that says, why are we lifting weights in the gym? We're just hitting a golf ball. And I think McIlroy wants to drive that point home. You also saw it the other day, if you follow David Ledbetter on Twitter. Again, Twitter's a great place to bitch about stuff if you're a high-profile person. Oh, this is terrible. Oh, that person's horrible. There's very little interesting information on Twitter, which is probably why I don't spend too much time on it anymore. But nonetheless, so you've got David Ledbetter putting out there that he's upset that Trip Eisenhower and Charlie Reimer from Golf Channel, again, back to Golf Channel, our only television outlet for golf, have been putting out there that they're concerned about the things that Ledbetter is having Lydia Ko do with her swing as he, Ledbetter, tries to build her into this A-swing concept that he has put out in a book. And it's a good book. I don't necessarily buy into the concept, but it works for Lydia. And so Ledbetter complained on Twitter that those two guys were spreading misinformation and misleading people about what they were trying to accomplish, Ko and Ledbetter, with the swing, and then what the move meant to do. And again, complaining that those guys don't know what they're talking about. You want fair and informed, not unfair and wrong, more or less. And I haven't listened to what Charlie or Tripp have said. I have no idea. I don't know what their critique is. And frankly, I don't care. It doesn't matter. But that's where these guys are coming from. And I guess that I don't want to lead that into a discussion of how the media is supposed to work, because the media is going to work how it's going to work. But rather, I think that this goes to show you that these guys are not, again, once again, they are not robots. They don't just play golf and that's it. They read the things that are written about them. They have concerns about how they're perceived. Some of them are downright paranoid about how they're perceived. And that's okay. That's being human. There is nothing wrong with that whatsoever. But when we talk about statistics, and we talk about data, and we talk about mechanics, and we try to make the argument that people try to make the argument that the data can tell you everything, that it just matters what their technical abilities are, and that decides whether they make the 5 or 6 footer, whether they make the up and down to win. That this is again proof that that is not the case. Because when you stand over that putt or that chip or that shot and you think about all the people that doubt you or think you're wrong or you're heading in the wrong direction, sometimes you believe them and you hit a bad shot. Sometimes you say, F them, and you hit a great one. And then McIlroy comes out on Thursday in the tournament, shoots 467, which was the second best score in the morning wave. 66 was the best score in the morning wave. Three guys shot it. And then Camilo Villegas went out and shot 63 with a bogey on the last hole. But that's a good start for McIlroy. On a golf course that doesn't necessarily make a whole lot of sense for him because the Poano is kind of weird to putt on the greens. You got to be very particular about where you put shots. He's very aggressive. He's a good driver of the golf ball, but he's very aggressive with his iron shots. He likes to fire at pins. If you get into bad spots, three putts are likely. He is a very streaky putter. There are more three-footers or putts inside 3 feet missed at Riviera than any other place on the PGA Tour. That doesn't bode well for a guy who's a streaky putter. So all of those things kind of seem to work against McIlroy, but nonetheless, he shot 467, only hit about half the fairways, and he only hit about 11 greens. He hit 11 greens. So he did what he thought he was going to do. He said on Wednesday, if you hit 12 greens around here, you've done really well. Well, he did just about that. So if he could do that three more times and shoot 16 under par, there's a really good chance he wins the golf tournament. That's just the reality. The record score at Riviera all time is 20 under par, Lanny Watkins. No one shoots 20 under par other than Lanny Watkins 30 years ago in this tournament. So that's what you're looking for. You're off to a great start. Now, was that partially motivated by hearing from Brandel Chambly, oh, I don't know if he should be lifting weights and all that? Well, probably. Yeah, and that goes into it. And I think motivation matters. Now, sometimes you know the motivation. You hear it and see it in the press. You hear it and see it online. You see a player express that frustration on Twitter or whatever. You know what their motivation is. Sometimes you don't know. Vaughn Taylor, we knew the motivation, but we didn't know the motivation. You didn't know until after the fact, because no one at that who was covering Pebble Beach was paying attention to the Web.com Tour, or Vaughn Taylor on the Web.com Tour, for that matter. I was paying attention to the Web.com Tour, and I didn't think about Vaughn Taylor. I didn't know he had the flu. I didn't know he couldn't eat. I forgot about the boating accident. Didn't know he was first alternate until I saw him get in. And then all of a sudden, as he starts to play well, the motivation becomes clear. I let something get away, and I want to get it back. And I really appreciate it now because I let it get away. Bam! One! Got it. McIlroy's motivation is pretty clear, especially as he becomes continually more obsessive about showing everybody that working out is not going to kill you, because this morning or last night he shared a video on Facebook of him doing an ab workout in his hotel room because he was quote-unquote bored. I know. People work out when they're bored. I tend not to work out when I'm bored. I tend to do other work or spend time with my children or play golf, things like that. So I don't quite get that. But he's again, trying to prove the point. I am ripped and I'm playing good golf. There is a connection between the two, and he feels that. And so take that, Chambly. I find that really interesting. I find that is really, truly revealing about these guys. That, again, tells you, this stuff gets under their skin. It does. And that's not to say to pat ourselves on the back, either as fans who tweet nasty things to these guys when they play poorly, or media that write nasty, sometimes uninformed things at these guys when they play poorly. That's not the intent here. We're entitled to an opinion, and we're entitled to our own analysis, and we have the brain and eyes, and we can do that. But that these guys react to it and are motivated by it or dissuaded by it, it's something to keep in mind. It's something to be aware of. It's just that's something if you got to pay attention to those things. And as my wife told me earlier this week, I expect a lot of people, so I assume people see these things. That's not always the case. You probably do because you're listening to this, but not everyone does. So it's just something that I think augments your experience as a sports fan when you start to not understand completely, but have an idea vaguely of the psychology that goes on in an athlete's mind from minute to minute, because it really changes what they're trying to accomplish and all of the bad stuff they're trying to block out and all the good stuff they're trying to let in. Like Kevin Nealon's character in Happy Gilmore. You got to block out the bad, remember the good. Feel the flow. Ride the bull. That is true. It's absolutely true. And the more you watch Happy Gilmore, the more you realize that completely unintentionally, because this movie was not intended to be smart, how smart it is. In a silly way, but it's there. The subtlety is there. It really is. It's fascinating. Okay, so let's transition to Spieth. Spieth opened with 79, his worst opening round score in PGA Tour history, his third worst score in his short PGA Tour career. He double bogeyed the last with a 3-putt from 8 feet, which is really all you need to know about his round. He played the final 7 holes and 6 over par, turning what was a lousy first 11 holes, where he was, 2 over par, I think, and turned it into a 79. That's not good. That is not good. And on the putt for 80, for 79, he almost missed. He almost shot 80. He's next to last in the field. There are 144 players in the field. He is tied with John Ha for T-142. 144 is Steve Bowditch, who I think shot 80. So, yeah, this is unexpected. You don't expect Jordan Spieth to shoot 79. But last year at the Deutsche Bank Championship, he opened with a terrible score, and it looked like he was starting to fade a little bit. Then he started to come alive at the BMW Championship, and then he obviously won the Tour Championship and became the FedEx Cup champion. Spieth has these kinds of moments, and he is perfectly willing to reveal what motivates these kinds of moments. And he talked about it a little bit last week at Pebble Beach when he said that he started to stroll into golf tournaments after winning a Kapalua by 8, so Singapore, Abu Dhabi, Singapore, Pebble, thinking it was always going to be that way. That he is at the best he's ever going to play, and he's going to stay this way for a while, and every week's going to be easy. He's just going to step off the plane, go to the course, kick everyone's ass, and go home to the next play or to the next place. And that hasn't been the case. He hasn't won any of those 3 starts. And that's not to say he has to win. Winning's hard. But he had an opportunity to win in Abu Dhabi. He had a second round 73. The other 68s, if you replace that 73 with another 68, he wins the golf tournament. Singapore had an opportunity to win, came out of the gate like crap. First and second round, couldn't deal with the heat, just didn't feel that great, and then played 2 good finishing rounds that left him a shot off the pace. In Pebble Beach, he had terrible wedge play, and he missed greens on easy shots, and for whatever reason, he seems to have convinced himself that he kept thinking targets were as big as Kapalua, 50 by 50 greens, and you could hit the green, you could 2-putt, and you could just kind of roll using his putting ability, and that's not the case. And that he kind of backdoored his way into almost a T20 finish, I think it was T21 at Pebble Beach, and that he could just kind of turn it on when he needs to. It was almost like that last round was the worst possible reinforcement of what he was thinking, because he jumped up the leaderboard from a guy that made the cut on the number into top 20, which is basically a 40-person move on Sunday. And so, I can do it. I can just turn it on and get it back, and I'll be good. And he comes to a place in Riviera where he loves it. He considered apparently going to USC because of potential access to Riviera Country Club. He finished T4 here last year. One shot out of the playoff with eventual winner James Hahn and Dustin Johnson and Paul Casey. He played in an NCAA here, and he lost to his buddy Justin Thomas, but he played well and really has fond memories of this place. And what does he do? Goes out and shoots 79. Puts himself in bad positions off the tee. He puts himself in spots where it's short-sighted, hard to get up and down, and he just doesn't. He doesn't get up and down. The putter can only save you so many times, and when you're either exhausted or you're down on yourself, all the things are working against you. All of a sudden, your consummate faith that you can get it in the hole again and again and again to save your ass stops. And I think he kind of felt that for the last 7 holes, where it's just like, oh, again I got to do this. And I think the culmination was an 18 where he's like, I haven't done this all day. I just don't have the pace right. And I think there was something very poignant pointed out. I don't remember where it came from. Maybe even Spieth himself. The pace is absolutely crucial at Riviera. Because if you don't pace the putts well, and this is true on POA in general, because you got to pace bumps, you got to pace speed, you got to pace line. Poa just is a tough grass to read. I think it is as difficult to read as Bermuda for someone who doesn't live in the South. If you're a northerner and you're trying to play in Bermuda, it stinks the first couple of rounds. If you are a southerner or used to Bermuda and you're trying to play on Poa, good luck. It's really hard. And for whatever reason, Spieth got into poor pacing, and the first putt he hits on 18 goes by 4.5 feet, and he hits the second putt, and it didn't even kiss the hole. I mean, it even touched the lip. It was a terrible putt. And he just looked like a guy who had had enough. And good for him for not losing his cool, slamming clubs, breaking clubs, turning into a hermit in the group of three. He still talked to Michael Greller and Fred Couples and Justin Thomas, and he seemed to be smiling, maybe because he knew it was kind of that moment of humility that every person that's an athlete, every person really, goes through every now and then, where you're so high in the world and you think like everything's going great and you can't lose, and then you lose and you look bad and there's nothing you can do but smile, take it like a man or a woman, and learn from it and try to do better the next time. And if you can do that, if you can learn from the next time, then you become a better player, a better athlete. So this is an opportunity for Spieth. And I think he genuinely views this way, that he's hit his kind of rock bottom here, that last week he must have thought, okay, well, I got it back, we're good. And he thought his swing was in tune, and maybe it is. Maybe it's just a smidge off, and then you kind of get it magnified once you kind of start going sideways and going backwards, and all of a sudden you're like, I just can't do anything, just screw it all. He needs a mental checkup, and he just needs to decide that, yes, targets are smaller, I need to be more precise, I need to get back in that grinder's mentality where even when I was winning the Masters by a zillion, I still grinded over every shot. You got to get back into that way of thinking. And if he gets into that way of thinking again, then he should be able to do well. Because that's what you have to do when you have a great short game. That's where the small details matter. That's where you shine. You care about details. If you're a long hitter and you just smash the ball, details don't matter as much. You know you're going to hit it far, hit the right side of the fairway, hit in the rough, whatever. I can hit a wedge in. It's fine. I'll make my par. And you take advantage of the times you hit the ball straight or where you want, and you just live with the ones where you don't, so long as you're not off the earth. It's different for a guy that's not as long and doesn't have that kind of length, that has a great short game. Really, like, all right, I got to hit the fairway, got to hit where I need to go. I may have a longer club in. I need to be able to make these putts. And Spieth needs that moment of reflection. So I think he's going to be able to do that and succeed. He definitely is not going to make the cut this week, barring around near 60 today. He's not going to make the cut. But hopefully this is an opportunity for him to reframe where he sees his game right now, where he thinks about what he thinks about on the course, and get in a position to succeed going through the Florida swing, heading into the Masters. Finally, the last thing I want to cover this week is a piece out of Golf Week by Adam Shupak on PGA Tour Champions/Champions Tour. So first, if you didn't know, what is the Senior PGA Tour changed its name, probably 10, 15 years ago to the Champions Tour. And then this year, they changed the name again to PGA Tour Champions. Yeah, I think they did that because people didn't necessarily associate the Champions Tour with guys that were really good on the PGA Tour and are 50 plus. So they wanted to rebrand it with the PGA Tour name and add Champions to the end so that you knew, hey, these guys won on the PGA Tour. They're good, so we should watch them. And it kind of aligns with what they've done with PGA Tour Canada, PGA Tour Latino America, PGA Tour China. All those things have their own name. So that makes sense. But Shupak wrote about it because the tour is kind of in this state of flux. So it doesn't get a lot of attention. The media doesn't really pay it a whole lot of attention. No one really talks about the golf that's played out there. It gets less coverage than the LPGA. It's kind of on par with the Web.com tour in terms of coverage. Maybe even less than that sometimes. And Kenny Perry said, very interestingly, that he feels the PGA Tour is considered a freak show. And that no one gives them any love, despite the fact that really good golf is being played out on the Champions Tour. And it is. There is really good golf on PGA Tour Champions. You should still call it the Champions Tour, I'm sorry. But there is good golf out there. And no one gives it any attention because, like with the Web.com Tour, those things are of little consequence to the history of golf. Except for the senior majors, which there are five. So for five events, 5 weeks every year, people get into Champions Tour golf a little bit. But it's also because when the PGA Tour, or when created the senior PGA Tour in 1980 was the official first season. When they created it, the guys that were playing were Arnold Palmer, Jack Nicklaus, the Gary Player. I mean, those guys, Nicklaus didn't come along until later. But in the 80s and 90s, those were the guys. Who wouldn't want to see those guys play? And then, the next generation come along, and the next generation wasn't quite as popular. You had Tom Watson and Hale Irwin, and Tom Watson's still very compelling, but Hale Irwin kicked some ass, and he was kind of its own story for 5, 6, 7 years, where he just dominated the Champions Tour. It was like, man, Hale Irwin's just killing everybody. He's just knocking down old guys left and right. So that was a story for a while. And then he kind of went through this lull of, who's going to come out and drive interest? Because the big three were gone. Hale Irwin was starting to get on the decline. I mean, he's almost 70 years old. He's been around. He's done this for a while. And then you had kind of like, all right, well, who's going to carry this tour? And you didn't have an answer. And you still don't, really. But you have a lot of good players. You got Bernhard Langer, who's dominated. But he isn't a figure that the public necessarily gets behind because, one, he's not American, and, two, he is pretty quiet. He's a great guy. I love spending time with him last March in Florida for an Adams event, but I didn't know him personally before, and I don't think that, not because he's not welcoming, he's just quiet. So it's hard to engage with somebody who is kind of got a quiet dignity about them, and a quiet, gentle, they're good. It's hard for people. So you've got this dominant player that no one really knows, despite having been in the public eye for 35 years. And then you've got a crop of players that are eventually going to come. You've got John Daly, who comes in May, who everyone kind of hopes will be a spark plug for the tour. Kind of the same way everyone hoped Fred Couples would be a spark plug, except Fred Couples has a bad back. John Daly doesn't. He wants to play. So I think he's going to be really good for the Champions Tour. But after that, the next generation beyond that are the guys that played golf in the Tiger Woods era, including guys like Phil Mickelson, Ernie Els, get Davis Love, Vijay Singh, those guys who have tried their darndest to stay on the PGA Tour as long as humanly possible and avoid playing on the Champions Tour. And the question becomes, will those guys even bother to play? They've made so much money in their lives. Do they need to play more competitive golf? Do they have an interest in it? And we don't know the answer to that. So that's kind of the big question mark about the Champions Tour's future is, will the guys who made a ton of money that were the superstars of this era, will they decide to continue to compete? And will they want to do it against each other in a friendly format, not in big cities, not on big courses in most cases, but in smaller places where the pro-am is kind of the driver of the economic engine of the tournament, that it is kind of a corporate outing atmosphere. Whereas on the PGA Tour, those guys had security, and they could avoid people, and they didn't have to talk to the media if they didn't want, and they could just be there, and that was enough. And now that's going to change. Will those guys do that? And the answer is no one knows. So it was an interesting piece from Shupak, who does pay attention to kind of those smaller, interesting stories that sometimes just fall through the cracks, and Adam does a great job with any of them, but especially those. And I tried to put something together with the PGA Tour champions this year for this podcast or for a radio podcast where I could say, okay, well, we'll interview a Champions Tour player once a month. I said once a week. And they're like, well, maybe we could do once a month. It's like, okay, well, then you don't want the coverage. And if you don't want the coverage, then fine, I'll stay away. But I really do think that these guys are fascinating. And because they're not under the constant pressure and spotlight of the PGA Tour, they'll actually tell you stuff that's interesting. They're free from the kind of the chains of being PC because they don't want to piss off a sponsor. They don't want to get their name in the paper in the wrong way. And that's the double-edged sword of the Champions Tour. They don't get a lot of press, so they can say what they want. It's awesome. It's great. Go to a Champions Tour event if you're a media person and go interview a Champions Tour player. It is fun. They say what they think. They let things slip. They're not always on message. I love that. And not because it's controversial, because it's real. That's what you want. You get real out on the champions. Right? You got guys who are real appreciative of what they accomplished. They are really still driven to compete. They're having fun. And that's what the Champions Tour really should be billed as. Fun. Not old. Fun. It doesn't matter who's playing. As long as they're good and it's fun. And that's what the Champions Tour needs to be. If I could give any advice whatsoever to Greg McLaughlin, who runs the Champions Tour, and we had some time together in the fall at an event for the Constellation Senior Players Championship, which will be held at Caves next year. That's the advice, is make it fun. Bill it as fun. And if you can do that for the general public, then you get more people who are really interested in it. All right, that's going to do it for us this week on the show. Many thanks to you for listening to our program. Please give us some feedback with a 5-star review over at iTunes. Leave us your comments and questions. And also, you can email me, ryan@thegolfnewsnet.com. Let me know what you think about the podcast. Or shoot me a quick note on Twitter, @RyanBellingy. I'll respond to your tweets. Even if they're mean, I'll give you something in response. It might be mean back, but I'll respond. Next week on the show, we're going to talk about how everything turns out at Riviera. We'll probably get a little bit into the Women's Australian Open, which, because of the time zone difference, is really hard to talk about with any kind of degree of relevance. So we'll talk about that as well. And we'll start to think about the Florida swing as the PGA Tour moves to West Palm Beach, Florida, for the Honda Classic. So until next week, I'm Ryan Belge. Thanks so much for listening. We'll talk to you on Tuesday with our next interview, and then next Thursday or Friday with our new full edition of the 19th Hole Golf Show. See you next time.